And good evening. Welcome once again to One Step Beyond, albeit 12 minutes later. Well, actually, not 12 minutes later than usual. 12 minutes later than scheduled starting time, but usually this broadcast does get started 5 to 10 minutes behind time, usually due to the weighty information that needs to be gone over at the beginning. My co-host Nip Tuck is not here this evening. He will be back again next week. My name is Dave Emery. For those of you who are not familiar, I'm the voice behind these stentorian pipes and rough attitude. And if you want to stay tuned for the next 3 hours or thereabouts, closer to 2:45 at the time, you're going to hear some amazing information. We're going to be talking about what may very well have been the very first nuclear test and what may have involved the very first casualties of a nuclear weapon. We're not talking about Hiroshima, and we're not talking about the Trinity test in Alamogordo, New Mexico. We're talking about an explosion right here in the Bay Area, specifically at Port Chicago in Suisun Bay, or on Suisun Bay. In July of 1944, there was an explosion at Port Chicago, which may very well have been a nuclear explosion. We're going to talk this evening about that, in as much as it is the virtual anniversary of the bombing, the atomic bombing of Hiroshima in 1945. In a couple of days, it'll be the anniversary of Nagasaki. There was a fantastic article in a publication called The Black Scholar, in an article written by a man named Peter Vogel, and he makes what I think is a very excellent case that, in fact, the very first test of an atomic weapon took place in the ammunition ship E.A. Bryan, which was the ship that exploded at Port Chicago, that it involved a test of the U-235 gun, the uranium-235 gun, which, in its naval-borne, ship-borne form, was the first type of nuclear device to have been studied under the auspices of the Manhattan Project. Again, Vogel makes a very good case that, in fact, the first testing of an atomic weapon did not take place at the Trinity site in July of 1945 in New Mexico, but rather took place right up in Suisun Bay in July of 1944. And what's more, approximately 320 sailors, most of them black, died in that explosion. So, and he makes out an excellent case that it was a deliberate explosion, not an accident. So, plug in your tapes and pull up your chairs and get ready for some rather dramatic information this evening. Again, this particular broadcast is intended primarily for taping. We may have some time for some phone calls at the end if I move briskly through this, and I hope to. At the same time, because of the highly technical nature of what we're going to be reading, I think you're going to want to tape this program. It will be on permanent file with Archives on Audio, a tape duplication service which stocks all of our archive programs. The Radio Free America shows, the Guns of November programs about the assassination of John Kennedy and others are on permanent file with a tape duplication service. And the name of that service, while I'm on the subject, I might as well give it to you quickly now. I'll give it to you slowly at the end. The name of the service is Archives on Audio. That's Archives on Audio, P.O. Box 170023, Box 170023. That's in San Francisco, zip code 94117-0023. The phone number is area code 415-346-1840. Write or phone to the attention of Paul, and again, neither Nip nor myself nor this station makes any money off of this arrangement. This is set up FYI. Speaking of archive programs, coming up on the evening of August 29th, that'll be a Monday on sister station KKUP at 91.5 FM, in glorious mono only, will be Radio Free America program number 10. That's the first of a four-part series about the Aryan Nations neo-Nazi network, and beyond that, it is a history. It is also an umbrella history of the evolution of Native American fascism from 1934 to present. That's Radio Free America number 10, August 29th, Monday, 8 p.m. to 12 p.m., KKUP 91.5 FM, mono only, so don't have your stereo light on. Be tuned in and be ready to tape, because the archive shows, as the program tonight will be, are intended specifically for taping, and there's some butchered English for you. At any rate, those of you who are in a position to do so, please get ready to tape tonight's broadcast, because you're going to wish you had. You wish you had if you don't. Again, it will be on permanent file with DAVCorp, but some very, very thought-provoking, undoubtedly what will prove to be very, very controversial information one way or another. I think it is very, very compelling information and something which has to be dealt with. Again, get ready to tape. We're going to talk about what appears to have been the very first test of a nuclear weapon, one which was not only tested deliberately on human beings, in this case American sailors, most of them black, but it was tested right here in the Bay Area, right here in our own backyard. And again, I think this is a program which it will be of great interest to all Americans, citizens of any place, given the import of the the dawn of the nuclear age and how sinister it appears to have been. This is a program that will be of great interest to people who are interested in Afro-American affairs, black American affairs. It'll also obviously be of tremendous interest to anyone and everyone with an interest in peace and disarmament, in particular, anti-nuclear activists in particular. So if you fall into any one of those categories, a human being or anything else, please tape tonight's broadcast because, again, given the very controversial and technical nature of a lot of the information, I think having this record to peruse at some length, greater than the purviews of our time slot this evening will allow you to, I think that's going to prove essential. So please get ready to tape the program. Again, you're going to be putting your own foot in your own rear end if you don't, I think, a lot of you. So, having said that, we're going to take a musical break. I'm going to catch my breath, and then we're going to proceed with a very, very important program, and I'm going to begin by giving you a rough rundown of the material this evening, and then I'm going to give you a detailed summary at the end, because again, this is quite technical in nature, and given the importance and controversial nature of the material, we always have important and controversial material, but this is going to be somewhat more so than some of the other programs we do. At any rate, short musical break, then we're going to begin with our account of what happened at Port Chicago. Was it the first nuclear explosion? Welcome to tonight's One Step Beyond broadcast. This is going to be an archive show. For those of you who eventually hear this program on tape, we're going this evening of August 7th, 1988, and specifically in observation of the anniversary of the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Hiroshima's anniversary was celebrated yesterday, Saturday, August 6th. Nagasaki, will be celebrated, I believe, Tuesday. I may be wrong. I'd forgotten whether it was August 8th or August 9th offhand. I believe it was the 9th, but I may be wrong. At any rate, we are now in between the anniversaries of the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Those events took place a little more than a year after an explosion, supposedly of a U.S. ammunition. Well, it was a U.S. ammunition ship that exploded in July of 1944, specifically late on July 18th of 1944. The explosion was attributed to the large amount of conventional explosives on board this ammunition ship, the E.A. Bryan. Port Chicago, for those of you not familiar with the Bay Area, is on Suisun Bay up in the northeastern part of the Bay Area. It's right next to the Concord Naval Weapons Station where was eventually incorporated into the Concord Naval Weapons Center where Brian Wilson, the peace activist, had his legs cut off by a train in a very well-publicized incident in September of 1987. Now, the focus of the broadcast this evening is going to be on an article in a publication called The Black Scholar. Specifically now, this is The Black Scholar, Volume 13, Numbers 2 and 3, and this from the spring of 1982. So The Black Scholar's issue, Volume 13, Numbers 2 and 3, from the spring of 1982. Now, this particular article is by Peter Vogel, last name V-O-G-E-L. He is a New Mexico native and obviously a very skilled researcher who began investigating, as a matter of chance, the explosion at Port Chicago. The title of his article, again, Black Scholar, Volume 13, Spring of 1982, is called The Last Wave from Port Chicago. And it's by Peter Vogel, copyright 1982, by Peter Vogel. Now, the focus of Peter Vogel's argument, and we're going to delve into that argument in all of its complexity and all of its length, is that basically the explosion of the E.A. Bryan on July 18th of 1944 was not in fact a conventional explosion, but was a nuclear explosion, a deliberately triggered nuclear explosion, one which was the first test of the type of atomic bomb that was used on Hiroshima. As he explains, there were two types of atomic bombs dropped on Japan, the U-235, quote, gun weapon, which was dropped on Hiroshima and was called the Little Man, the Little Boy, and then the Fat Man, which was dropped on Nagasaki, which was plutonium-239. This was called the Fat Man. Now, the gun weapon consisted basically of firing one mass of triggering atomic fission by firing one mass of U-235 into an exposed mass of U-235 at the other end of an unrifled 5-inch naval gun, hence the name the gun. Basically, it's a gun in which one projectile of U-235 is fired into another one through this unrifled 5-inch naval gun. That accounted for the long, skinny shape of the Hiroshima weapon. The Nagasaki weapon, the Fat Boy, involved triggering fission in plutonium-239 by placing explosive charges all around it and having those explode inward, thereby imploding the plutonium-239. This weapon was called the Fat Man. Now, Vogel's contention is that, in fact, the gun weapon, the type of weapon that was dropped on Hiroshima, was, in fact, tested on board the E.A. Bryan deliberately, and not only that, but it was tested on U.S. sailors, most of them black, as it happened. We're going to delve into the substance of his argument and examine what I think is a very compelling argument that, in fact, the U.S. government has been covering up many important aspects of the early atomic testing period, including one which is absolutely scandalous and which points very strongly in the direction that the first atomic bomb test took place not only right here in the Bay Area, not only on U.S. soil, but deliberately involved the sacrifice of American military personnel, most of them black, in order to find out the reactions of service people exposed to this weapon. Now, I'm going to give a brief summary of the arguments that Peter Vogel presents here. First of all, he came across a device called the 10,000-ton gadget. The history of the 10,000-ton gadget. This appears to have been a history from the Los Alamos Weapons Center in New Mexico of the Port Chicago weapon. It's a history of a 10,000, presumably 10,000-ton gadget, perhaps refers to 10,000 kilotons of the yield, or may refer to the gross weight. In any event, history of the 10,000-ton gadget, according to Vogel's thesis, is the history of the development of a nuclear weapon that was set off at Port Chicago. There's a curious reference to the explosion being of a hypothetical nuclear weapon being, quote, of a classic Port Chicago type. And this led Peter Vogel into an examination of the Port Chicago incident, and he basically sought to explain three things. One, did the U.S. have, in fact, have the capability to build a nuclear fission weapon as early as July of 1944? Was there sufficient U-235 available? Had the bomb been specified by July of 1944, that is, were the technical details of its design drawn up in final form by that time? Was there any evidence that the Port Chicago explosion was nuclear in origin? And he answers all three questions in the affirmative based on the research that he did and that I'm going to present here. Vogel goes on to maintain that the history of the 10,000-ton device was in fact put together by a group which was known as O5 or T7. It was really the same group headed up by a fellow named Professor or Dr. Joseph Hirschfelder, and who was working on the Manhattan Project, and he maintains that there was simply a name change, that O5 and T7, responsible for analyzing the theoretical damage of a nuclear device, were in fact the same group, and this is the group that he hypothesizes drew up this history of the 10,000-pound gadget, as it was known. He points out that right after the Port Chicago explosion, which took place again July 18th, 1944, a little over 44 years ago, he points out that right after this, namely August 1st of 44, the focus of the Los Alamos effort shifted from the development of the U-235 gun weapon to the development of the PU-239 implosion weapon. And that's interesting in light of the fact that it came right, he points out, that happened right after the Port Chicago explosion. O5 was reclassified T7 in November of that very year. He points out, too, that the amount, he goes on to explain the principle of the U-235 gun. Basically, there were two kinds of weapons dropped on Japan. There was a U-235 gun weapon and a plutonium-239 implosion weapon. Basically, the first weapon produced nuclear fission by firing one mass of uranium-235 down an unrifled 5-inch naval barrel into another mass of uranium-235 at the other end. This was called the gun weapon. It was long and narrow. It was called the Little Boy. And this was the weapon dropped on Hiroshima. On Nagasaki, a weapon which used PU-239, plutonium-239, as the fissionable material and set it off, detonated the chain reaction by compressing the PU-239 by detonating explosive charges all around it, which were shaped in such a way as to explode inward, literally actually to implode the plutonium-239. And again, the basic contention of Peter Vogel is that the Port Chicago explosion, which took place aboard the Liberty ship E.A. Bryan in Port Chicago, was a deliberate test of the U-235 gun weapon, which was later dropped on Hiroshima. the official explanation from the Department of War, the Department of War, later the Department of Defense, was that the Hiroshima bomb, the gun weapon, had not been tested prior to Hiroshima due to the fact that there was not enough fissionable material available. As Vogel points out, there was more than enough fissionable material at the end of 1943 to have tested the gun weapon. Therefore, the Department of Defense was simply misrepresenting the facts. He also points out that by February of 1944, the specifications for the 5-inch unrifled naval gun barrel for the gun weapon had been completed. So the specifications for the weapon had been completed. The gun weapon, that is, the U-235 gun weapon, the Little Boy, the weapon used on Hiroshima, had been completed by February of 1944, and that in fact three of these weapons had been ordered by March of 1944. Again, July 18th of 44, we have the Port Chicago explosion. By August of 44, the emphasis in the Manhattan Project shifts from developing the U-235 gun weapon to perfecting the plutonium weapon, the PU-239 weapon. He goes on to point out that had the Almogordo, New Mexico test, which was a test of the plutonium weapon in July of 1945, had this been the first test, it's unlikely that the history of the 10,000-ton gadget would have referred to a classic Port Chicago-type explosion. It would have been more likely a classic Trinity-type explosion. He also points out, too, that the Port Chicago explosion could not have been of a PU-239 weapon because the type of tamper that was needed was simply not available at the time of the Port Chicago explosion. And those are some of the salient points in pointing out why he feels that there are many more to them. Those are some of the historical, the major historical points that he makes in going to illustrate his argument. There are a lot of other major points he makes. He talks about the switching of the booms on board the E.A. Bryan right before the explosion to carry a much heavier load. He also talks about a fascinating connection between the Los Alamos laboratories and the Port Chicago explosion. There was massive documentation on the Port Chicago explosion at the Los Alamos laboratories, and most of this paperwork had been prepared by one of the most important names in tonight's broadcast, namely a fellow named William J. Parsons. And William J. Parsons was a fellow who was involved with the development of the U-235 gun weapon. He basically developed it. He was a commodore and later a captain and later an admiral, I believe, in the United States Navy. And he developed the U-235 gun weapon. He was the bombing officer on board the Enola Gay, which dropped the weapon. And he also had a lot to do with planning the Bikini tests. He was also the fellow who drew up almost all of the vast bulk of the material, the 400 to 600 pages of material on the Port Chicago explosion that was found at the Los Alamos National Laboratory, basically the laboratory where the atomic bomb was developed under the auspices of the Manhattan Project. He also points out, too, that there are many similarities between the Port Chicago explosion and the Bikini tests, and the aforementioned William J. Parsons was chairman of the Operation Crossroads, of Operation Crossroads, which resulted in the Bikini Atoll tests in 1946. Vogel goes on to cite a number of different compelling pieces of physical evidence indicating that the Port Chicago explosion could not have been a conventional explosion and was more likely a nuclear explosion, and again, the detonation of a U-235 weapon. Oh, incidentally, before I go on to the physical evidence in this introduction here, it should also be pointed out that in the Los Alamos National Laboratory records of Port Chicago were indications that two of the railroad cars that had been unloaded onto the E.A. Bryan had been, the records of what was on them were deliberately destroyed. For what reason, we don't know, but Vogel finds that interesting. Many of the physical points that Vogel brings, many of the points of physical evidence here, what we've been going over are some of the historical indications that, in fact, Port Chicago was a test of a nuclear device, specifically the U-235 gun weapon, which was later dropped on Hiroshima. And he then goes on to cite a number of very compelling pieces of physical evidence pointing in the direction of a nuclear rather than a conventional explosion. In a nutshell, some of those pieces of physical evidence. First of all, the description of the blast does indicate something far, far more powerful than the 1,780 tons of TNT which were on board the E.A. Bryan, roughly 1.78 kilotons for future reference in terms of nuclear technology, 1.78 thousand tons of TNT. One of the interesting things about the blast itself is that all of the eyewitnesses said that there was a brilliant flash of white light, just as there had been at Hiroshima. He goes on to point out that the enormous temperatures plus the electromagnetic radiation developed by a nuclear explosion causes the atmosphere, the molecules surrounding the explosion, to become incandescent. He said this does not happen. This is characteristic of a nuclear explosion and does not happen at the much lower temperatures of a conventional explosion. A conventional explosion of the type that we're told happened at Port Chicago would have given off a yellow glow rather than the distinctive white flash of a nuclear explosion. He then goes on to discuss something called the Wilson condensation cloud. The eyewitnesses to the in particular, a pilot who happened to observe the explosion mentioned that right after a flash, a smoke ring formed and that the mushroom cloud went right up through the smoke ring. As Vogel goes on to point out, one of the things that was discovered in Operation Crossroads, the bikini test, was that when a nuclear device is set off on the water, something called the Wilson condensation cloud is formed, and it looks like a smoke ring surrounding the explosion. Again, this is characteristic of a nuclear explosion in the water. Vogel points out that the smoke ring, in all probability, was a Wilson condensation cloud and that this could not be accounted for satisfactorily by the conventional explosions. That's another point he makes. He also points out that the seismographic records of the explosion, of the Port Chicago explosion, are inconsistent with a conventional explosion. That explosion registered a 3.4 on the Richter scale and was felt as far away as Nevada. He says that's inconsistent with a 1.8 kiloton device. Then one of the most interesting pieces of evidence that he cites is a movie, a motion picture of the Port Chicago explosion. The Navy said that this was a Hollywood simulation of the Port Chicago explosion, which had been made up to justify the purchase by the Department of Defense of Port Chicago for addition to the Concord Naval Weapons Center, this in the early 1960s. However, when the film was examined, it was found to be of a type that was only produced up till 1950. The interesting thing is, this means that the Navy was misrepresenting this film, that it has to have been from before 1950, and appears from the still photographs shown here and from Vogel's analysis of it to actually be a filmed historical record of Port Chicago. As he points out, this is quite damning because it's extremely unlikely that someone would have been sitting there making a motion picture of an ammunition ship sitting at a dock. That is not the best use of what was then very precious motion picture film. He theorizes that the Navy was deliberately covering up the fact that this was an actual motion picture record of the Port Chicago explosion, indicating that it was deliberate and pre-planned rather than an accident of some kind. He goes on to... the reason basically the Navy wanted to purchase Port Chicago was because the rest of the Bay Area was shielded by the hills surrounding Port Chicago from the force of the blast. That's one reason why it didn't affect anything outside of the immediate area, although it was a massive blast. Then Vogel goes on to describe what I personally feel is the most compelling piece of physical evidence backing up his argument, namely the indications from the displacement of the crater underneath the E.A. Bryan that this has to have been a much, much more powerful explosion than the 1.78 kilotons of conventional explosions could have produced. In a test which measured the effects of nuclear weapons that he cites, the effect of a 5-kiloton weapon on wet soil produces a crater roughly 53 feet deep and 132 feet in diameter. The crater underneath the E.A. Bryan was roughly 31 feet deep and 800 feet in diameter. And as he points out, the force of the blast would have been greatly attenuated not only by the steel hull of the ship, but also by displacing a huge amount of water. There was a huge tidal wave, and by moving out the muck on the basis, the muck from the bottom muck that would have been lying on top of the hard rock pan. That crater, 31 feet deep and 800 feet in diameter, was in the rock, the actual geological strata underneath underneath Suisun Bay. That there was obviously a whole lot of muck on the bottom, as well as the huge amount of water that was displaced by the blast and the attenuation of the blast itself. And again, that's not consistent. It's obvious that there was a much more powerful blast than the 1.78 kilotons could have produced. Again, the 53 feet in diameter, 153 foot deep, 132 feet in diameter was for a 5-kiloton blast, not going through a steel hull, not going through all that water, and not displacing all of that muck. 1.78 kilotons, we would expect something perhaps, again, an unshielded explosion, even if it was unshielded, and the E.A. Bryan explosion was heavily shielded, of something maybe more on the order of 17 feet deep, and 45 or so feet in diameter. again, I am not a nuclear scientist, and I can't evaluate much of the technical data here critically past a point. To my layman's viewpoint, though, the most compelling piece of physical evidence is the displacement of rock underneath the E.A. Bryan. It is obviously much, much greater than what the official explanation could have produced. Again, the official explanation is, well, we'll be generous, we'll call it 1.8 kilotons. The displacement was it would indicate something of at least perhaps 5,000 kilotons, possibly quite more. In any event, that, to my way of thinking, is the most compelling piece of physical evidence backing up Bryan's argument. Interesting thing, too, he goes on to talk about a couple of other interesting aspects of the Port Chicago explosion. He hypothesizes that possibly the high cancer rates found in Contra Costa County may be due to the fallout, the post-explosion fallout that took place after the Port Chicago explosion. He says it's not inconsistent with what has been observed in other places, and that there would have been a lot of fallout because of the water and all the muck on the bottom, as well as the pieces of wreckage that were thrown into the air and vaporized. We obviously, I think, there are other factors that could be involved, chemical plants in the East Bay and so forth, but I think his hypothesis is worth looking into here. Food for thought and grounds for further research. He also talks about the reaction of the sailors on board the E.A. Bryan. He points out that although initially stunned by the explosion, they immediately rushed to help those people who were still alive, although later they mutinied and refused to work on any other ammunition ships. Most of the sailors were black, and that's interesting to evaluate in light of some of the other things we've talked about in this program, Jonestown and the possibility or the certainty, actually, that it was some sort of intelligence operation and other things we've spoken about. One of the things that Peter Vogel talks about concerns his theory that the sailors, that they deliberately wanted people around the ship so they could test the reaction of service people to an attack with this kind of weapon, that the response of the people involved was one of the critical pieces of data that the investigators sought to pursue here, and that they deliberately had people on board the Bryan and saw to it that there were casualties because they wanted to test the response of their compatriots. And again, the conclusion of Peter Vogel is that the explosion of the E.A. Bryan at Port Chicago, California on July 18, 1944 was not a conventional explosion, but rather was the first test of the U-235 uranium gun weapon, which under the auspices of Commodore William J. Parsons made its appearance at Hiroshima on August 6, 1945. We're going to take a short musical break now, and then we're going to get into the actual substance, the actual text of tonight's broadcast, this Peter Vogel article from the Black Scholar, spring of 1982. Well, good evening. Once again, that's about the third time I've said that on this good evening. We're going to now delve into the actual text of the article that's going into tonight's archives broadcast. Again, the title of the publication is The Black Scholar, Volume 13, Numbers 2 and 3 from the spring of 1982. The title of the article, The Last Wave from Port Chicago. It's by Peter Vogel, V-O-G-E-L, copyright Peter Vogel. Now, on the morning of August 6, 1945, during the hour when most employed residents of the Japanese city of Hiroshima were on their way to work, a single B-29 bomber appeared high in the sky above the city. Those who observed the plane concluded that a single observation flight was passing overhead. Suddenly, a brilliant white flash cut across the sky. The city was destroyed, and more than 80,000 men, women, and children died, some quickly, some slowly. On August 9th, the same disaster struck Nagasaki with the same results. The atomic bombs that were exploded in the air over those two cities were firecrackers compared to the atomic nuclear fission and fusion weapons which have since been developed. Over a year earlier, in July of 1944, a huge explosion had occurred at the Naval Ammunition Facility at Port Chicago, California. All public reports describe this disaster as an accident due to conventional explosives. However, a chance discovery led me to wonder if the Port Chicago disaster might have been caused by a nuclear detonation. Indeed, a detonation of a nuclear fission device of the same basic type as that dropped on Hiroshima. It was a simple twist of fate that got me involved in the study of the history of the early atomic bombs which were developed at Los Alamos, New Mexico, across the Rio Grande from the town where I live and work, Santa Fe, originally named the Royal City of the Holy Faith of St. Francis by its Spanish founders. Here, in the spring of 1980, I obtained at a rummage sale conducted by the Christ Evangelical Lutheran Church a document which had been taken from the Los Alamos laboratories in the autumn of 1944. I found the document at the box of, at the bottom of a box of unused photographic supplies and equipment that had been donated to the church. The document is entitled, History of the 10,000-ton Gadget, unquote. And it's reproduced in the first figure here. I traced the document to a Mr. Paul Masters, M-A-S-T-E-R-S, now a resident of Santa Fe, who told me that it was in a box of materials he donated to the rummage sale. Masters said he was employed at the laboratories as a photographic darkroom technician and photographer. Part of his duties were to operate a large blueprint-type machine upon which were made copies of bomb drawings and other originals too large for conventional copying machines. The original from which the copy was made is lost, probably destroyed when superseded by subsequent documents. If nothing else, the history is important because it apparently is the earliest known description of the progression of the explosion of an atomic bomb. And again, let me reread that sentence. That's the thing we're talking about. History of 10,000-ton Gadget is the title. If nothing else, the history is important because it is apparently the earliest known description of the progression of the explosion of an atomic bomb. It is very concise and contains previously top-secret information about the actual design of an atomic bomb. However, apart from the general historical interest of the history, the bottom line, step 11, reads, quote, ball of fire mushroom out at 18,000 feet in typical Port Chicago fashion. Again, the bottom line, step 11, reads, ball of fire mushroom out at 18,000 feet in typical Port Chicago fashion. Vogel goes on, this line caught my attention, and subsequently I learned of the disastrous explosion at Port Chicago in 1944. That explosion, according to eyewitness accounts, was characterized by a brilliant white flash and a ball of fire which mushroomed out above the Suisun Bay north of San Francisco to an observed altitude of 10,000 feet before its ascent was obscured by the dark of night. The document that I had found comparing a hypothetical nuclear explosion to the actual explosion at Port Chicago implied that the Port Chicago disaster itself may have been due to a nuclear detonation. If this were true, it was of major significance. It meant that the first victims of an atomic disaster were Americans, and that for all these years, government personnel had concealed this fact. In thinking about the possibility that a nuclear device was involved at Port Chicago, several questions come to mind. One, did the U.S., in fact, have the capability to build a nuclear fission weapon as early as a nuclear fission weapon as early as July of 1944? Was there sufficient U-235 available? Had the bomb been, and here's the second point, had the bomb been specified by July of 1944, that is, were the technical details of its design drawn up in final form by that time? Was there any evidence that the Port Chicago explosion was nuclear in origin? That's the third point. In my subsequent research, I discovered that the U.S. did have the capability to build a U-235 weapon at that time, that the bomb design was specified as early as February of 1944, and that there is evidence indicating that the explosion at Port Chicago was nuclear. Again, I'm going to repeat the three salient points here because much of tonight's argument turns on these three points. Again, Vogel says, did the U.S. in fact, or Vogel asks, did the U.S. in fact have the capability to build a nuclear fission weapon as early as July of 1944? Was there sufficient U-235 available? That's the first point. Second, had the bomb been specified by July of 1944, that is, were the technical details of its design drawn up in final form by that time? Three, was there any evidence that the Port Chicago explosion was nuclear in origin? In my subsequent research, I discovered that the U.S. did have the capability to build a U-235 weapon at that time, that the bomb design was specified as early as February of 1944, and that there is evidence indicating that the explosion at Port Chicago was nuclear. Now, those are the major points that of this first section of the article. And again, bear in mind that at a rummage sale, Vogel has come across a document called History of 10,000-Ton Gadget, and I'm going to read parts of that to you in a second. And that step 11 reads, ball of fire mushroom out at 18,000 feet in typical Port Chicago fashion. A curious line here. If the Port Chicago explosion was conventional, it wouldn't have been anything like a nuclear explosion. The next section of Vogel's article is entitled Capability. In establishing the fact of the United States' early, unannounced nuclear fission weapon capability, I was guided initially by the reference in the history, unquote, to the Port Chicago disaster, which indicated a 1944 time frame. Recall that 1945 time frame is the official version. The first officially acknowledged nuclear detonation was the July 16, 1945 test at Trinity Site, Alamogordo Bombing Range, New Mexico, a year after the Port Chicago explosion. If the history had been prepared after the Alamogordo detonation, certainly the formation of the ball of fire of a nuclear device would have been described as, quote, typical of the Trinity Site detonation. And recall, it was described as typical Port Chicago fashion. Continuing with Vogel's account. The history, in my opinion, was prepared in September of 1944 by a group at the Los Alamos Laboratories under the direction of Joseph O. Hirschfelder, H-I-R-S-C-H-F-E-L-D-E-R, currently affiliated with the University of Wisconsin at Madison and the University of California, Santa Barbara. An account of the work of this group, Group T-7, is found in the Manhattan District History, Project Y, The Los Alamos Project, Volume 1, LAMS 2532, Los Alamos, 1961, paragraph 11-20 in this account, or 11.20 in this account, 11.20 in this account, which refers to work accomplished at Los Alamos immediately following August 1, 1944, contains a description which parallels almost point for point the process described in the history of the 10,000-ton gadget. So here is paragraph 11.20 in the Los Alamos, in the Manhattan District History for the Los Alamos Project. And again, this talks about work which immediately followed the August 1st of 1944. Port Chicago is 7/18/44. Here's the description in paragraph 11.20 of the Manhattan District History. Much more extensive investigation of the behavior and effects of a nuclear explosion were made during this period than had been made possible before. Tracing the history of the process from the initial expansion of the active material and tamper, tubaloy, an inert neutron reflective material, through the final stages. These investigations included the formation of the shockwave in the air, the radiation history of the early stages of the explosion, the formation of the ball of fire, the attenuation of the blast wave in air at greater distances, and the effects of blast and radiations on human beings and structures. General responsibility for this work was given to Group T-7 with the advice and assistance of the British mission consultant W.G. Penney, P-E-N-N-E-Y. Now compare that with this section from the History of 10,000-Ton Gadget. There's a table here which says detonation is the first step. Then the second step here, and recall step 11 is the Port Chicago reference. Step 1, detonation. And these are all followed in a table by calculations, which I'm not going to bother to read you. They are extremely complex. 1, detonation. Step 2, detonation wave reaches tamper, and then this figure, 18.5 times 2.54 divided by 7 times 10 to the 5th. 3, tamper and active fully compressed. 4, neutrons multiply and shockwave hits tamper, 18 divided by 2 times 10 to the 7th. Step 5, shockwave passes through HE and case to reach air, 74 divided by 2 times 10 to the 7th. Step 6, radiation squirts out, temperature drops, and isothermal sphere formed. Step 7, strong blast wave expands. Step 8, ball of fire fully expanded. Step 9, blast wave reaches damage area. Step 10, in a test, blast wave would reach installation and observers at 10,000 yards. Also, ball of fire reached height of 2,000 feet and is completely disintegrated into turbulent convection currents. 11. Ball of fire mushroom out at 18,000 feet in typical Port Chicago fashion. Then again, let's compare that quote from the History of 10,000-Ton Gadget with this from the work of the T-7 group at Los Alamos from the official history. This immediately following August 1st of 1944. Much more extensive investigation of the behavior and effects of a nuclear explosion were made during this period than had been possible before. Tracing the history of the process from the initial expansion of the active material and tamper, tubaloy, an inert neutron reflective material, through the final stages. These investigations included the formation of the shock wave in the air, the radiation history of the early stages of the explosion, the formation of the ball of fire, the attenuation of the blast wave in air at greater distances, and the effect of blasts and radiations on human beings and structures. General responsibility for this work was given to Group T-7 with the advice and assistance of the British mission consultant W.G. Penney. Continuing. with Vogel's account. Los Alamos Laboratory's Theoretical Division Group T7, Damage, had been formed in November of 1944 by a change of name. Group T7 had been the former Group O5, Calculations of the Ordnance Division. Both O5 and T7 were led by Hirschfelder. In November of 1944, that's when the O5 to Group T7 name change was effected. In November of 1944, according to the Manhattan District History, Group T7 was given the responsibility for completing the earlier investigations of damage and of the general phenomenology of a nuclear explosion. Given the nature of the work assigned to the two groups that Hirschfelder headed before and after the Port Chicago explosion, and given the parallels between the paragraph quoted above and the description in the history, it is reasonable to conclude that Hirschfelder was linked with the preparation of the history, unquote. However, at this time, Dr. Hirschfelder declines to comment on the history. Shortly after the disaster at Port Chicago, the Los Alamos Laboratories were radically reorganized in structure, organization, and effort, effective August 1, 1944. This reorganization had, as its most substantial effect, the curtailment of all laboratories' work on the uranium-235 gun assembly weapon, which was to be detonated at Hiroshima. The decision was made to expedite the development of the plutonium-239 implosion weapon, which was subsequently tested at Trinity Site and detonated at Nagasaki. Interrupting here, now recall that Vogel's overall thesis is that the E.A. Bryan explosion, the Port Chicago explosion, was in fact a deliberate test of the U-235 gun weapon, and that in fact the authorities have been covering up the fact that the gun weapon was in fact tested prior to Hiroshima. Continuing with Vogel's account. There were two very different nuclear fission weapons detonated over Japan. The weapon detonated at Hiroshima employed the uranium isotope U-235 as the active material, and the weapon was detonated by firing one mass of U-235, a 60-pound projectile, down an unrifled 5-inch naval gun barrel toward a second mass of U-235 disposed at the opposite end of the gun as a target. Thus, the U-235 weapon detonated at Hiroshima was called the gun, unquote. It has been maintained by government history since the end of the war that the gun had not been tested prior to the Hiroshima delivery. The reason given for the detonation of an untested weapon is that insufficient U-235 had been produced to allow both a test and the Hiroshima detonation. The weapon detonated at Nagasaki employed plutonium-239 as the active material and was detonated by compressing a mass of plutonium-239 located at the center of conventional high explosive charges, shaped so that the force of the explosion of those charges was directed inward with implosive force. This weapon was known as the implosion weapon and also known as the fat man, unquote, because of its porky appearance. The gun weapon was known as the little boy. There are many indications that the plutonium-239 implosion weapon could not have been detonated at Port Chicago in July of 1944. Significant among these is the fact that the molded explosive lenses, which were essential to the detonation of that weapon, were not reliably tested until early spring of 1945. Therefore, if a nuclear weapon had been detonated at Port Chicago, it must have been the U-235 gun weapon. The government had contended that not enough U-235 had been produced and purified to allow a test before the bomb was produced on Hiroshima, but no one had ever verified the production statistics. I realized that the production statistics for U-235 for the years 1943 through 1949 had never been published. The contention that the U-235 gun weapon could not have been tested was therefore unsupported.